Hey, how's it going, everybody? This is Andrew from MNR.com, and I'm here today with a guy that I think is one of the most interesting people in BMX over the years, a great photographer and a great rider. His name is Chris Hallman. How you doing, Chris?
I'm doing good, thanks.
And thanks for being with us tonight. So I'm going to start at the very beginning. How'd you get into BMX in the first place?
I don't know. I was probably 8 or so, so I just had a BMX bike. And there were some older teenagers in the neighborhood that had some little jumps in the field behind my house. And they were pretty scary to be around because they were, like, scary, bad teenagers. But I would see them and... I saw that one guy in particular, I remember his name, and the bike he rode, his name was Eric Kropp, and he rode a Pooch, a P-U-C-H, and he had like a little, some little roller triples, and I remember just rolling over them on my bicycle, and then he jumped all three of them, and it kind of blew me away, I couldn't believe it, and so then I just rode all the time, and actually, probably a year or two later, a friend and I stole our first BMX magazines from the same Eric Kropp, I think. They had a fort in the woods, and it had a big box full of BMX magazines, and we went and took a bunch and went home and went looking through the BMX magazines, and I don't know, I was just obsessed with it for a long time thereafter.
And, Where were you at this time? Where do you grow up?
Pennsylvania, eastern Pennsylvania. It's near Allentown. It's about 20 minutes from New Jersey.
And at that time, I mean, I know now that area, there's a million riders. But back then, what was it like? Were there tons of people riding around there?
Until I was probably 15 or so, I didn't know anybody but me and like two or three other friends. I guess there were, you know, there were other people around, but until we got, started going to contests and things, we really didn't know anyone else in the world rode bikes.
Yeah.
We just kind of looked at magazines and did it ourselves.
And, okay, so this, that actually kind of leads into what I was going to ask you next anyway, but, so what about photography? When did you start shooting photos and how'd you get into it?
I think I was always interested, but I never had a camera until I was 18 or so. My mom bought me a camera, I think, for my birthday. And I just started taking pictures of BMX.
Yeah,
that was what I was doing all the time.
I know when I was a kid, like, I when I first started getting magazines and stuff, that was, like, really what got me into photography, and I feel like a lot of people sort of have a similar experience, but, so, for you, you are into photography, and you're into BMX, and this is jumping forward a little bit, but how does that turn into launching and editing Dread?
I just kept taking photos, and eventually I started selling some photos to Props Video Magazine, and then I did a couple articles in different places, and I got to know the guys at Props pretty well, and somehow we were just talking, we didn't like any of the magazines that were out at the time, and we thought we could do better. And, so they just, at some point, were like, hey, do you want to make the magazine and we'll pay for it? And I said, sure. So I went out to Chicago and lived with them and made a magazine. And I had never even used a computer before that, so it was kind of, I had taken photos and I had written a little, so I just figured it out as I went along and made a magazine.
one on the fly, basically. So how long was Tread Around for? And you said you lived in Chicago during that time.
Yeah, it was. It didn't last much more than a year.
Yeah.
And I lived in Chicago for most of that time.
So around that time, like I was riding at that time. I used to get Tread at a magazine store in the suburbs, like here in Boston. So like, what was the distribution like? I mean, they had it. That wasn't at a bike shop, you know. Was it huge? Did it have like a pretty wide distribution?
The first one I think we did 10,000, and then the second one we did maybe 15,000 or so, and we. Marco at Props had found a distributor, I think it was Rider Distribution, like a magazine distributor, and he found that right away.
Yeah.
So they were putting it in just wherever they thought it might do well. And then after the second issue, we had a publisher wanted to buy the title and just have us produce it. And so they wanted more, the distributor wanted more copies, and we thought this was going to go through and they were going to pay for it, so we just went ahead and ordered like 30,000 of the third one. And after we had already ordered it and they were already printed, we had gone to an Interbike and things didn't seem to be going the way these people wanted it to. They couldn't get the money they wanted out of ads, so they pulled out. And that left Marco with a huge print bill that he wasn't expecting to pay for. And that was pretty much what killed him.
That's a drag. I mean, I was a kid, you know, obviously I was a kid when that was out, but I was super psyched on that thing. And I can remember, I can remember feeling like it was a big loss, you know, like, I'm sure you felt that way a lot more than I did, but...
No, I don't know. I look back and kind of regret that I didn't try harder to stick with it. Like, I wasn't the one selling ads, and I didn't want to deal with that. I'm not, like, much of a salesperson, and if I had been that person, maybe I could have. I just wanted to take pictures and write stories, so.
Well, you know, that's different kind of people in the publishing industry, that's for sure, you know, and it takes both kinds to make it happen, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway, so jumping forward a little bit, you know, actually, before we get to that, I was talking to my friend that I work on the site with today, Nick, and he brought up a picture that was on a cover of Dig a couple of years ago, and it was a picture of Craig Kleckner, and if I remember correctly, it's a photo of him like blasting like an air on like a dirt quarter pipe, basically.
Mm-hmm.
We were talking about it, and when you shoot photos, do you try to like focus on specific things that you know you want to you know, sort of present, if you want to present BMX in a certain way? I mean, you've been in a position to, like, show BMX to the world in a number of different capacities over the years. And could you just elaborate on that a little bit? Like, I guess the underlying question is, sorry, this is a convoluted question, but what makes a good BMX photo for you, you know, personally? What are you looking for when you shoot?
I guess I want to see the environment. And... I guess the environment. I want the environment to look good, and then I want the trick to look good, and it all to come down. I don't just want it to be a guy on a bike, and you can't tell what's happening or anything.
Right.
How it relates.
It needs to be in context.
So I wonder.
And so, how'd you get involved with Dig?
I don't remember. I met Sandy Carson around that time. He had just started coming to America and staying with a friend of ours. But I don't remember if that happened first or I got involved. Salted Pig first. I think I just saw it and was really excited about it. And so I probably just sent him photos. And I used to just write things and take photos and send them to him, and I didn't really, you know, expect anything or know what was going to happen, and then they'd show up and they'd be printed, so it was pretty neat.
Yeah, definitely. So were you always just, sort of work with them in like a freelance capacity or? One time I read an article in there a long time, not too long ago, a couple of years ago, about you moving to Central America and building trails down there, and I don't know how long you lived down there for, but it seems like that's a pretty amazing experience, so I wanted to ask you about it, you know, sort of what led you down there, and can you talk about it a little bit?
I don't know if I moved there, I just wanted to go there for a while. I had Spanish in, you know, high school and college, but couldn't really speak it. And then I didn't think about it much for a few years, and then I started to meet BMXers who were from Spanish-speaking places, and I'd be like, oh, I studied Spanish, I can say some things, and I'd start trying to talk, and then they'd talk, and I didn't understand anything they'd say, and I was like, oh, I guess I can't really speak Spanish. And, I was just kind of bored with life and wanted to do something different and see something different, and thought I could learn some Spanish and have a unique experience. And everyone tells you that you can't just drive down to, you know, Central America, that you're crazy, but I didn't think that was the case, so I just figured I'd do it. And so I did. I just drove around Mexico for about a month, and then I went down to Guatemala. I had gone to Guatemala to do a show about 2 years prior to that, which was neat, and I just thought it was a really amazing place, and I wanted to, I was only there a couple days, and, you know, I didn't get to see much, so I wanted to go back and see it. So I went there and rented an apartment and just hung out, and I'd ride my bike around, and I met kids that rode, and I wound up getting in touch with a guy that had organized the show I did, and I hung out with him. He had a bike. She was actually grew up in Los Angeles. He was born in Guatemala, grew up in Los Angeles, and then moved back, and he had a bike shop. And then he introduced me to different people, and there was a family there that owned a BMX track, and they were basically like the MBL of Guatemala, this family, and they wanted dirt jumps at their track, so they hired me to build dirt jumps, and I lived at their house for a few weeks and built this, like, X Games-looking 10-pack. They wanted really big jumps, even though no one there had ever jumped jumps before, so I built these really big jumps out of, like, dust, and it was pretty unusual experience. Just like sun up to sun down for several weeks.
Just
these piles of dust and trash and a little tiny hose that they had to fill up these buckets on top of the telephone pole. And just gravity fed the hose, and it was like a half inch diameter hose that would go for like 200 yards, and the water would just kind of trickle out. And I'd have these mountains of dust and a little trickling hose, and I had to make dirt jumps out of it.
The photos of the kids riding from there that were in that issue are amazing. I think they're like some of my favorite photos I've ever seen in a BMX magazine.
Yeah, thanks. They were cool. They were, you know, really fun kids.
Yeah, were they just psyched? Like, I mean, it just seems like you look at those photos and you can, I don't know. It's like,
yeah, they were like, it was weird. They treated me like I was Michael Jordan or something, you know. No one knew who I was or even had ever heard of me, but they were just like, that was amazing that I was an American BMX guy. When I went back, there was a Haro distributor there, and I talked to them. They wanted to have me ride for them for a while there.
Sick.
And do shows, and like, it was really bizarre, though. They had a skate park, but it was really expensive, like, even by USA standards. So there was really no one there ever. And they had a couple of kids that they sponsored. And they just, part of their like sponsorship was that they had to be at the skate park every day, all day. And it was really weird. And they just wanted me to like go to shows. And he said, like, we just want people to see your blue eyes and see you ride. It was really weird. And they wanted me to hang out. They wanted me to be at the skate park every day, like 8 hours a day. And it was, I don't know, it was bizarre. I felt like they were trying to take advantage of me, so I didn't do it.
Well, yeah, I think you're probably right, but but it would have been a strange experience, too, that's for sure.
Yeah, I wish, you know, again, looking back, I wish I had just done it, but whatever.
Okay, so switching gears from there, but still obviously talking about BMX, I read that Anthem 2 is in the works now, and when that video first came out, the first Anthem, I was so psyched on it, and I'm still so psyched on it even now. And one thing that stands out when you watch it, and not necessarily the whole video, but particularly the part that you're in, it seems like it was kind of filmed, and correct me if I'm wrong, just sort of out at the trails over the course of like maybe a few sessions, and I think what stands out to me about it is that it's, you know, really different from how people make videos now. So first of all, am I right about that? Did it sort of just come together like relatively quickly?
I've never been any good at, you know, being filmed. So if someone, I would never like try something over and over and over again. So it was just me riding and Stu was there filming.
Yeah.
So it's probably a lot different than the way Stu would make a video now, you know, because he's kind of used to making them now.
Right, right. And you sort of, I think that's where my next question is going. It's like, how do you feel about the way videos are made now where kids spend 2 or 3 years or something stacking up clips to have this like epic part? I guess do you think that's kind of a little unnatural?
It's weird. It is fun to watch.
No doubt. No.
Sometimes. I wouldn't want to do that for myself, but it's, I don't know. Yeah, it's definitely weird. And kids stress a whole lot over it. It's like a job, so.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a strange thing.
And sort of another thing is, sort of not for the kids who are actually out there doing the riding, but what about, what about the kids that watch stuff like that? Do you think it's having an impact on, you know, sort of young riders that just see that and think that's normal now?
Yeah, well, it's pushed the, you know, the tricks, because kids think that stuff is normal, so it's interesting to just watch it progress in that way and see how good kids get really quickly now. That's when I was young, we didn't have anything like that to see, so that stuff seemed impossible.
Right, exactly.
Now kids do stuff that we thought was impossible when they're like 14 and they do it really easily. So that's interesting to see.
It's really strange, you know, it's like just, I guess it just goes to show how much it's your perspective, but, you know, like for me when I was a kid, like skating or whatever, nobody did kickflips. And like now I'm in my 30s and I still don't have a good kickflip, you know? But like, you know, it's the first trick kids learn now or whatever. But do you think there's any kind of a negative impact on kids at all? Like, or is it just, you strictly look at it as just positive?
I don't think it's either. I think it just is what it is.
Right.
I think. Because I was in the tricks in the same way. You know, I wanted to do what other people were doing. They just weren't the same tricks. And, just is what it is. I don't think it's negative or positive. Like, it'll, you know, a person is who a person is, and they'll ride for whatever reason they want to do it. So it's just how it is now.
All right, sweet. So I guess I got a couple more questions, and then we can wrap it up. And this one's related to learning tricks. So for a while, you worked for a woodwork camp. I don't really know too much about what you did there. So did you work with kids, or did you work for Woodward, or can you just talk a little bit about what you did?
Yeah, I made all their advertising, so I made all their magazine ads and brochures, and I didn't really work with kids at all. I just went around, and in the summer I mainly took photographs, and it was a neat opportunity because I got to take lots and lots. I was still using film. And they paid for all that, so I just got to take photos all day, every day, and have it all paid for. And then at the end of the summer, I would make the brochures and magazine ads and, you know, stationery and T-shirt designs and whatever else they needed. I made a website for them at one point. So, it was a good time. I learned a lot and got to hang out at Woodward for several years.
Yeah, I heard they have some pretty good stuff to ride there. And where are you living now?
In Hurley, New York, which is about, it's in between Albany and New York City. I met a girl and moved here with her, so.
That's rad. Congratulations.
Thanks.
I was going to ask you next, how'd you wind up there? what are you doing for work nowadays?
I'm a bicycle mechanic now.
Oh, that's great. In Hurley, are you working there?
Yeah, that's right. Kingston, it's the town, right? It's like the big town that's right next door.
That's rad.
Yeah. And just tinker on bikes.
All right, well, that's really all I have, Chris, for now. I appreciate you taking the time out to talk to me. And like I said before, I know everybody else involved with the site is going to be a real psych to listen to this. So thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, and for everybody listening, if you want to learn more about Chris and check out some of his photos, visit chrishallmanphoto.com.